ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Piki mai kake mai. I'm Alison Balance and welcome to this Our Changing World podcast from RNZ. The New Zealand bee industry is definitely on a roll, and William Ray is off to find out about a project that aims to help beekeepers find the best places to put their hives.
It's a club day for the Wellington Beekeepers Association, and about a dozen would-be apiarists are getting an up-close look at a hive, some of them for the very first time.
These are drones, so you have a different size. All right, big eyes so they can see the queen and the mating flight.
This is the club's treasurer, John Burnett. Today he's giving the group a crash course on what to look for while inspecting a hive.
All they do is wander around eating.
Yes.
They're like the worst stereotype.
Yes.
All they
need is TV and they're right.
This hive John's inspecting is one of 800,000 registered in 2017. That's a jump of more than 100,000 hives compared to the previous year. A lot of that jump is being driven by the booming value of Mānuka honey, and there's a lot of interest in finding ways to gather that honey more effectively. That's why scientists, beekeepers, Māori landowners and software engineers are all working together to create something called the Honey Landscape Map. The dream is that this map will reveal the honey-producing potential of native stands of vegetation all around New Zealand, both on conservation land and in private hands.
That's the sort of concept we're working on at the moment. But again, we are working in conjunction with a lot of the stakeholder and end-user groups to make sure that the product is sort of fit for their purpose as well.
This is Gary Houliston. He's the head of the honey mapping project at Manaaki Whenua. And it's not just a map of which flowers are where. Gary says the model's going to incorporate things like the weather, flowering patterns, microclimates, so it can predict the best places to put a hive in real time.
Yeah, I mean, we are hoping to actually get into that kind of reactive space, if you like. Going back to some of the previous work we've done on things like mass seeding, that work is really about trying to predict events, and ideally for the industry, of course, how can we, you know, determine whether we're heading into a good season or not. And obviously the industry's come off the back of a couple of fairly poor seasons. And obviously particularly as we get more challenges through things like climate change and so on, we do need the model to be responsive to some of this.
Yeah, because I mean, what's a typical year now might not be a typical year a wee way down the track.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and that's the thing. And I mean, I think that's what the industry's seen as of late. There's kind of no such thing as a typical year anymore.
So that's the dream, but it's still early days yet, because working out how much nectar and pollen a plant can produce under different conditions is a complicated business.
So could you just set the scene a little bit of like where we are?
We're at the University of Waikato,
yeah.
In the greenhouse compound.
So there's a few whole lot of plants in nettings that look like
these are all natives.
Yeah.
This is Stevie Noe. He's a PhD student at Waikato University, and his role within the Honey Landscape Project is researching the honey-producing properties of one particularly valuable plant.
We've got a whole bunch of Mānuka plants and the cultivar Martinii.
I've actually never seen Mānuka flowering like that before. They're quite pretty, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, I think these are cultivated for their large pink flowers.
Stevie Noe is trying to work out all the different factors which affect the nectar and pollen yields of Mānuka.
There are a lot of things that affect nectar flow and nectar chemistry. Soil fertility, temperature, sunlight, time of the day, where the plant is through its flowering season can also affect nectar chemistry.
But even in the controlled setting of a greenhouse, nature often gets in the way of Stevie's painstaking measurements.
Yeah, the ants are a bane to our nectar collection efforts. So they, if you don't control the ants, they take all the nectar. So,
right, okay.
Yeah, you've got to be diligent with control.
Just as we're talking, Stevie's starting work on a new Mānuka experiment. We wander out of the greenhouse across the road to a scruffy bit of land on the outskirts of the campus, where he's about to plant a whole new plot of manuka in bags full of sand.
The sand has no nutrients, so we'll be able to feed our specific fertiliser mixes to the plants and see what the effect of withholding nitrogen or phosphorus are on manuka growth and flowering.
Obviously, manuka's a major focus of the mapping project because it's so valuable to honey producers. But the final model has to include data on every major flowering plant in native bush, plus they need to account for introduced plants in that bush, not just the natives. And for every plant, they need to understand all those things Stevie was mentioning: genetics, soil composition, sunshine requirements. To put it mildly, there's a lot of variables. Gary Hulliston again.
It sort of varies on in sort of several different dimensions, if you like. I mean, some of it is kind of climatically driven. So even if you've got similar suites of species in different parts of the country, you will get different resource production from those areas. Also, of course, the different species produce very different amounts of nectar and pollen. So actually, species like manuka are generally pretty hard work for bees. They don't produce a lot of nectar or pollen. And, I mean, obviously you will get bees differentially foraging on different species as well. So these are all things we have to try and take into account in the model to at least give us a good estimate of the, you know, the sort of number of beehives you can run per area in different parts of the country.
I mean, it seems like an extremely complex model to put together. I mean, you know, I think the model most people are familiar with is sort of climate models, and it almost seems like a similar scale of thing. There's so many different interconnecting factors to take into account.
I mean, at Manaaki Whenua, over the last few years, we have actually had quite a lot of work already in this sort of area. So there's already been some modelling work done on nectar and pollen flow. We've also done a lot of work on sort of the climate effects of plant production, particularly work around things like mass seeding, which a lot of people would have heard about. So we do have quite a track in some of this work. We're not sort of starting from ground zero, if you like, but absolutely getting to a model that will give us some predictability around this is certainly a science challenge.
But the scientists don't have to gather all this data themselves. Gary says beekeepers all around the country are cooperating on the project.
Because, I mean, some of them have data sets that go back 40, 50 years.
And they're happy to share those with you? Because, I mean, it almost seems like the kind of thing that would be like trade secrets.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a mixed bag. Some are and some aren't. I mean, a lot of the ones that have been more forthcoming are actually probably some of the real sort of old school beekeepers, if you like, and a few of them sort of nearing retirement. So, I mean, their interest has probably become a little bit more academic than commercial. So we've been fortunate to tap into a few of those people that have been extremely helpful. But, yeah, of course, a lot of other players in the industry aren't going to hand over a lot of their what they see as their, you know, their trade IP, as it were.
If they can pull it off, the upside is potentially enormous, particularly for people like Victor Goldsmith.
I'm the general manager of Ngāti Porou Miere Limited Partnership. Miere is a Māori name for honey. We are a collective of landowners on the east coast, Ngāti Porou landowners.
Over the last few years, Te Tiriti or Waitangi settlement deals have transferred ownership of large amounts of farmland to iwi like Victor's. But because it's been difficult for Victor and his iwi to access the finance needed to develop that land, it's started to revert to native bush.
The irony is that the land reverted back to scrub, and people used to look at us and, you know, call us marginal landowners. And then as the manuka honey and the science that sat behind that drove the value of that particular product, you know, the opportunities started to come about.
Victor and Ngāti Porou have partnered up with Manaaki Whenua, hoping the mapping project will give them a more detailed understanding of the value of their land for honey production.
We've got gold sitting on our hills, which we need to look at differently, hence the reason why we're involved in the honey landscape. I use these little catch cries like, the key is the tree. You know, there's a lot of science and research being done on the honey, but not a lot of science and research being done on the actual resource itself. And so when I ask very basic science questions around, is my manuka strain different from others around the country? We had to send interns around the country to gather the leaf sample to do the DNA testing, and now we've proven that the East Coast is different from Northland in terms of DNA, which is quite important for me from a provenance perspective. If I'm starting to look at how I might market my honey, I've also got Western science that supports that, but I've got a rich story that sits behind that in terms of our cultural association with Manuka in particular. So that's one of the work streams.
It's not all business, though. Victor's getting his family involved in the mapping project, both to reconnect them with the land and to get them involved in science.
My daughter was the first one, you know, because she was finished university, and it's a good little summer job to go around the country and start collecting Manuka leaf samples and tagging the tree and GPSing and all that sort of stuff. So, and then we had my grandnephew involved, had my stepson involved, had my niece involved. People think that, you know, might be a little bit of nepotism there, but it's about succession planning as far as I'm concerned, because there was no other people that we knew of at that time that would be able to go out and have, you know, have the capacity to go out and do the work.
Landowners like Victor sometimes have a tricky relationship with beekeepers. Mostly it's a mutually beneficial relationship, but there are some bad actors.
The greed factors come in and people placing hives on our boundaries, which is another reason why we're involved in the Honey Landscape Project, to sort of manage that beekeeping pressure.
Victor's hoping the Honey Landscape map will help clamp down on unscrupulous beekeepers using Manuka on his land without his permission. It's called boundary riding, putting lots of hives next door to someone's property to harvest the flowers on their land.
And I'm in discussion with the regional council and the Gisborne District Council to look at introducing potentially a bylaw once the research has been finished, so that we can go back to some of these unethical practices and behaviours that have been displayed by people in the industry, to say that you've got far too many hives on your land, you know, so why have you got 100 hives when our data, our research suggests you should only have 10.
And is that a fairly critical part of getting a bylaw like that passed, is sort of having the science to underpin it, sort of saying this area of land can only support this number of hives?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the council wants.
Overstocking and boundary riding isn't just a problem for the commercial honey industry.
Hey, get off my microphone, bee.
Back at the Wellington Beekeepers Association, John Burnett says it's seriously affecting hobby beekeepers. Many members have lost hives because there just isn't enough food to go around all the bees.
Wainui Mata, for example, the coast road, has, last I heard, 600 beehives, which is far more than the area can actually sustain. Mm. And therefore overstocking and therefore poaching, if you could call it that, on each other's territory, not that that's quite the right wording, but yeah, it's becoming increasingly a problem, and ethics seem to have gone out the window.
John's hoping the Honey Landscape map can help address the problem.
I often try and get the Sure Quality, who look after the apiary register, to tell me how many hives are in a certain area, but they're very, very reluctant to divulge that sort of information because of privacy regulations. So you really don't know if you're encroaching on somebody else's territory or there are too many hives in a certain area even now.
Hmm.
And some sort of coordinated data base would be a good idea. It'd be nice to know that there are already several hundred in this particular area, therefore there's no point in me putting hives in the same area.
Mm. Yep. So if it linked it up with that kind of database, that might be quite handy.
Yep, yeah. It would. Mm.
The plan is to have the Honey Landscape map up and running within the next 5 years, but Gary Houliston says there's a hell of a lot of work left to do.
It's really getting some of that nectar and pollen data together. There's a lot of emphasis at the moment on Manuka, and we've certainly made some good headway on Manuka, but we are very interested in other native honey-producing species. So some of that work is kind of very much still to come or just kicking off now, really. We're hoping to have a sort of preliminary iteration of the model in the next sort of 12 months or so to test with some of the stakeholders, and then we'll be looking to further refine that before the end of the project.
Thanks, Gary. And a big thanks to Gary Houliston from Manaaki Whenua Landcare Research, Stevie No from Waikato University, Victor Goldsmith from Ngāti Porou Mairi Limited Partnership, and John Burnett from the Wellington Beekeeping Association. And thanks to producer William Ray. I'm Alison Balance, and this Our Changing World podcast first aired on RNZ on the 25th of October 2018. Online, we live at rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. You'll find all the audio for more than 13 years' worth of shows there, and each story has a written feature and photos and useful links. You can listen to our stories, or you'll also find some handy ways of listening to us as a podcast there. If you're an iPhone user, you can subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts. If you use a Google or Android phone, then you'll want to head to Spotify or Stitcher or somewhere like that. Or download the free RNZ app and find us there. We are on Facebook and Twitter as RNZ Science. Thanks for listening. Bye for now. Kia pai tō rā.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.